Hello and welcome. You're listening to the Urban Experience Podcast. I'm Jules Warren in Group One discussing mental illness. I will be talking about how mental illness intersects with SUD, substance use disorder, and how the stigma of drug abuse hinders a person from seeking help. I also have a special guest, Susan Plant. She is a board-certified adult psychiatric nurse practitioner with a master's in nursing, along with holding an MBA. Susan is going to explain the journey of the mentally ill from possibly being incarcerated to ending up in a mental institution. And we're going to bring her on in just a bit. Let's start with how mental illness intersects with SUD. So it's commonly theorized that individuals with severe, mild, or even subclinical mental disorders may use drugs as a form of self-medication. When an individual develops a mental health disorder, changes in brain activity may increase the vulnerability for problematic use of substances by enhancing their rewarding effects, reducing awareness of their negative effects, or alleviating the unpleasant symptoms of the mental health disorder, or the side effects of the medication being used to treat it. The National Institute on Drug Abuse shows that 13.5% of young adults, that's nearly one in three, aged 18 to 25, had both a substance use disorder, SUD, and mental illness in the past year. Some common serious mental disorders associated with chronic drug abuse include schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, manic depression, ADHD, anxiety disorder, post-traumatic stress, panic disorder, and antisocial personality. Another obstacle associated with SUD is the impact of stigma. The internalized feelings of shame, isolation, and hopelessness hinders the drug user from seeking help or getting the care needed. This is especially apparent with a homeless person or someone with a criminal record. It is suggested to start a conversation or have an intervention about their drug addiction. The key is to show compassion and understanding. Start taking steps to get help. Expressing your concerns honestly, listening to them, and offering information on different ways they can address their drug problem is the suggested combination. Try to avoid a lecture or a bribe. Be prepared for denial and don't expect one single conversation to fix the problem. Finding them a safe space to tell their story, such as a support group, will promote healing and help alleviate the stigma. Empathy and patience is the key. The National Institutes of Health, the NIH, reports that stigma against children and adolescents is a serious concern because of its negative impacts, including decreased feelings of self-worth and willingness to enter treatment, and because of the long-term effects of untreated mental or substance use disorders. Compared with the adult population, stigma against children with mental disorders is less well studied. A review of studies of stigma related to childhood mental disorders concluded that stigma research lacked conceptual underpinnings and that the evidence base was quite sparse. The National Stigma Study on Children, which was the first to include a nationally representative sample of participants to examine public stigma of childhood mental disorders, specifically focused on attention deficit, hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, and depression, comparing public attitudes and knowledge of these disorders with daily troubles the stigma incurs. One set of analysis from this study showed that 81% of the adult sample perceived children with depression to be dangerous to themselves and others, compared with children who had daily troubles. A smaller but substantial proportion, 33%, also perceived children with ADHD to be dangerous. Large proportions of the sample thought that children and adolescents with mental health problems would likely experience rejection at school, 45%, and would experience stigma into adulthood, 43%. Many respondents also had negative views of the benefits of medication. The researchers concluded that some public beliefs about mental illness and treatment were based on a lack of accurate information and could present barriers for providers and for parents and others who seek treatment. However, there have been strides to improve the issues of mental illness. On July 25, 2023, the Departments of Labor and Health and Human Services released a proposed rule intended to strengthen enforcement of the 2008 Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act and improve patients' ability to access care for mental health and substance use disorders. At the same time, the agencies also released a technical relief seeking feedback and data requirements related to network composition and a possible enforcement safe harbor, a second report to Congress as required by law, and a fact sheet summarizing enforcement efforts during 2022. The proposed rule is a big win for the behavioral health community because it will finally close loopholes that insurance companies routinely use to deny care for mental health conditions and substance use disorders. The proposed rule clarifies and strengthens requirements related to the analysis of non-quantitative treatment limitations, an area where violations continue to persist. If finalized, the new rule is expected to take effect on January 1, 2025 for group health plans and on January 1, 2026 for individual health plans. This might sound like a positive advancement, however, there is still a lot of ongoing work to be done. The U.S. is encountering a massive fentanyl and opioid epidemic, becoming one of the United States' biggest killers, endangering public health, the economy, and national security. Much of this increase has been due to the open border crisis, which has allowed the cartel to easily bring in the fentanyl across the border. It has become too easy for people seeking an escape through drugs to obtain illegal drugs on the street. Another issue on the rise is with gender dysphoria we are seeing take place, especially with our younger adults, happening through our school systems. Although there is still ongoing research and talk about the root causes of gender dysphoria, the DSM and other organizations classify gender dysphoria as a mental disorder. Young people wanting to be non-binary believe they are animals, and wanting a pronoun or numerous pronouns instead of having a name or an identity is a mental disorder. This adds to how and what can be done to assist this issue. The Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, may qualify gender dysphoria as a disability, which could act as an open door to better research and care. The bottom line is the issue of mental illness in America needing to be addressed as a top priority. In the meantime, on an individual basis, we can help any person we know that is experiencing drug misuse or other symptoms such as anxiety and depression with understanding and empathy. Helping them commit to self-care is an important element as we find better ways through the government to address mental illness and SUD. All right. Let's talk to our special guest, Susan Plan. Hey, Susan, thanks for being with us.
Hey, Jules, I'm excited. Thanks for having me.
All right, so explain exactly what you do, where you work, how it deals with mental illness.
All right, I am a psychiatric nurse practitioner. I work at the Brattleboro Retreat in Brattleboro, Vermont. Shout out to Vermont. And we are a large freestanding psychiatric hospital. We are primarily inpatient. And we do have a small outpatient department that does a partial hospitalization program. We have a ketamine clinic there as well now, but we focus primarily on inpatient adults and children as well.
So people are admitted that have mental illness, correct?
Yes, you can't be admitted unless you have a diagnosed mental illness, and you have to be, because it's a locked facility, the 99% of the patients are involuntarily sent there, and you need to be a danger to yourself or others by various means to be admitted to the facility.
And so who decides that? Would that be the state? Would that be their psychiatrist? So how does that work? Like, who designates them as having mental illness?
Right, so someone in the community, you would need to be a certified professional that would be able to sign the involuntary paperwork to have you sent to my facility, mostly from an emergency room. Patients would be either taken from the community and brought to the emergency room for an evaluation and deemed to be a danger to themselves or others. Usually it's a nurse practitioner or a medical doctor or troopers in the community. They're authorized to do the paperwork. They'd be brought to the emergency room, or sometimes they go to the emergency room on their own, and if everyone assesses them and feels that they are a danger to themselves or others, they would fill out the proper paperwork and they would be sent to my facility.
Who assesses how long they stay in there? Someone like yourself that works there, you look at their behavior patterns and that type of thing?
Yes, so we only have a certain amount of time by law to hold them involuntarily. That gives us a little bit of time to assess them. They're being monitored 24/7 by, medical staff and mental health professionals, so we get a real good idea of their, behavior throughout the day and throughout the night, and then we kind of have a, formulation about their diagnosis and treatment in the beginning, and then we kind of work through that as the days go by, and then we get a pretty good sense of whether they need to continue to be there or not. If they do need to continue to be there past the allotted time that the state gives us, then we have to take them to court to have the court involuntarily commit them, and then that would be up anywhere up to like 3 months.
Very interesting. And how many of the mentally ill people that come into your facility do you think have SUD?
I would say that number is on the rise, but probably I would say minimum 65% to 70% have active substance use disorders, and then maybe even a higher percentage of that have a history of that. Maybe not actively using when they do come in, but have a prior history.
So what do you think comes first, the mental illness or the substance abuse, or hard to say?
It's the chicken and the egg scenario. As we know, there's a lot of undiagnosed mental illness. And people self-medicate, and then they
get out of control with it.
Yeah, it can make their mental health issues worsen. Mm-hmm. They can get independent mental health issues from the drug use, and then you combine the two. It's very difficult to piece out, unless you have a good, clear history, kind of what came first. We call them co-occurring disorders, and they're co-occurring for a reason.
Right.
They kind of go hand in hand, so.
Right. So when someone first comes in, do you do a drug test on them to see what's in their system? I would think so, but is that part of the assessment?
Yep, that's part of the workup in the emergency room. Hopefully, if for some reason they don't consent to blood work when they're in the emergency room, that does happen. We will, ask them if they'll do a drug test when they come to the unit, and sometimes they refuse. We can't involuntarily take blood from them.
Oh, that's interesting.
So we have to. That makes it very complicated. When we suspect drug use, we're not exactly sure exactly what kinds of drugs. We have our, thoughts.
I'm surprised that would be the case, that it would be left up to them if they're not in a stable state of mind, for one thing, and you're trying to help them, so
right.
If they're on some type of a strong drug, I would think the first thing you would want to know is if they are. So that's surprising to me, but
it's surprising to me too. Still, after all these years, it's very complicated. I mean, we are skilled and we do understand the physiological aspects of drug use. We're able to: are you sweating? Are you tachycardic? Are your pupils dilated? Are they constricted? Are you
falling down?
Are you comatose? Are you incontinent? Are you not breathing? Are you just nonstop
raging?
But,
yeah, right.
So we narrow it down to different categories of drugs because they all are a little different in their manifestations of behavior. But it is complicated, especially some withdrawals are life threatening, especially like
right,
alcohol
exactly,
and things
yes,
like that.
Because they're obviously once they're in there, not getting the drugs that they have been taking, if
right.
so.
It
yes.
can be a very dangerous situation. So fortunately, because we're a locked facility, we monitor them 24/7, so we're able to catch if someone's going into severe withdrawal and could have life-threatening complications. We, are on top of it, but it's not an ideal situation.
So what is the ultimate goal of where you work? Is to get to assess what's going on with them and try to, then what happens when they walk out your door?
Right. I mean, so our goal is to get everybody kind of back to safety as quickly as possible, and then to get them back to the community. It is difficult because of the types of patients I have. They're very severely mentally ill. If you make it to a locked psychiatric unit, things are just not going well.
Right.
And it's a very dangerous situation. So, you know, 99% of the time, medication is the treatment of choice. And for the majority of my folks, they either don't want to take medication or are not consistent with their prescribed medication.
Right, so you cannot monitor them when they leave. You're just hoping that they stay on the program.
Yeah.
Right.
So, and different states have different kinds of ways they deal with involuntarily medicating people. In Vermont, you can, the court is not really on board with authorizing long-acting injectable medication, like they are in different states. So when people leave, we just try to hook them up with the best services we can and just hope that, you know, they're well enough to understand they need to continue their medications, but a lot of times they don't.
So it seems like it would, that creates like just like a revolving door.
It's a,
meaning like you're helping them for the moment when they're in your facility, and then you let them out, and then anything can happen. So what do you think as a professional, just being in the industry for years, that what good change do you think, positive change or needed change of dealing with everything you just mentioned should take place? Or
yeah, I mean, it's extremely complicated. It's sad to have patients stabilize over the course of weeks and months only to walk out the door and stop their medication and be back and start the whole process over,
right.
You know, within that day, if not within the week or the
right.
month. And so my particular population, the recidivism rate is extremely high, and you can look at, the combination of drugs and medication noncompliance. I mean, what do I think would help the situation? I do think the long-acting injectable medication, it at least buys you 30 days, if not 60, 90 days of having medication in your system when you do leave. And it gives you just enough time to, you know, get back in the community, get on your feet, see your outpatient providers, get stable,
right.
make some better decisions, have more time being healthy. And then those type of folks I see stay on their medications much longer than people who leave on oral medications and stop
right.
it.
Right. So in other words, when they experience a longer period of time of feeling calmer, mm-hmm. more normal,
yep.
then they were like, hey, I like this. This is better.
Right.
And they, you know, because a lot of them can end up, you know, going down some bad rabbit holes.
Yeah. They can hurt themselves.
Criminal behavior and, you know, rage and, you know, assault and battery,
yep.
That type of thing. I have a quick story I want to tell you. I was in a Walmart parking lot about 3 weeks ago, in my car, windows up, pulling out, and a woman comes out of her car and just starts attacking my car, ripping at the outside mirror. I get out of the car, of course. She starts assaulting me. It was a whole thing. And now that I've spoken with you, I'm thinking, you know, that she was probably, you know, has some type of mental illness and was not on her meds. Because to go into a total rage like that, from nowhere, not even having a conversation with her, obviously something's going on, you know, behind the scenes. So
Yep. There's
a lot of mental illness in America. It's a huge problem. We see it in so many different levels. So it's just something that just, I think, needs a lot of attention in this country. What do you think about that?
I am eternally hopeful. You know, I've been doing this for 30 years now. I've always worked in inpatient adult psychiatry, and
God bless you.
Yeah, I just love it. But I have seen over the course of 30 years, I know it still seems like we have no services and people can't get, you know, the access to care is terrible, and we're really failing as a country in that area. But there has been an uptick and a trend upwards of access to services. The most encouraging thing for me is, like, kids nowadays, they talk about mental health. They say, I'm depressed, I'm anxious. They talk to each other about it. I think social media has really helped that
absolutely.
As well.
Create a bigger conversation.
And so first, you know, I always see the first barrier to access is people acknowledging they do have they do need help. And they're, you know, the kids nowadays are quick to go see a therapist, and so I think the awareness now is definitely on the rise, although we still lag way far behind in access to care. but I have seen it go up and up over the course of 30 years.
So do you think a lot of the people that with mental illness, or at least that come into your facility, are homeless? Or, I guess, yeah, homeless.
Yeah, my particular population, there is a real large, amount of homelessness. There's, housing in general for people, never mind with mental illness. It's very hard for them to sustain housing if they're not taking their medications and they're getting, kicked out of hotels and apartments and
jobs, all, whatever,
everything.
Yeah.
So there is a large amount. We like to, we try not to send people to the streets. We like to get them into little programs or step down programs, anything we can. But it's very tough to not have housing for everybody that needs it.
Yeah, exactly. All right, thank you, Susan, for all your insight. That was great information, and God bless you for all you do. And we appreciate you coming in today.
All right, what can we conclude here? Without a doubt, mental illness in America is an issue that needs top priority attention and solutions. As we see the drug addiction numbers, the deaths associated with drug overdose, and the constant tragedies of our young adults shooting others, the question needs to be asked, what more can we do to resolve these issues and tragedies? In the meantime, on a personal level, we can help the people in our lives that struggle with mental illness or SUD with empathy and understanding. We can also get involved with our communities to volunteer at or help improve care and support facilities. Thank you for joining me today. Stay well, and I will see you at the next episode.